Good day, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to What Clinicians Want to Know. Today, we're going to talk about first-line and maintenance therapy for patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. We're going to be emphasizing ER-positive or triple-positive disease. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Virginia Borges from the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora, Colorado, and Dr. Ian Kropp from the Yale Cancer Center in New Haven, Connecticut. As with all of our programs, today we will be discussing the use of unapproved agents and regimens. So for more information, check out the package inserts for the various agents we're talking about today. Here's where we're heading today. We're going to start out talking about a little bit of biology and pharmacology as it relates to triple positive breast cancer, or as I've seen it now, TPBC. A new short name for that. And then we'll get into some findings from a survey we did of general medical oncologists. I'll tell you about in a second. We'll take a look at some of the data that's come out over the past year related to the question of first-line therapy. Of course, we have the big ASCO meeting with DB09 and TDXD. And before that, in December 2024, the PATINA study, very relevant to what we're talking about today. We are going to be talking about this survey. We just did it over the last couple of weeks. Of course, we love doing surveys, either of general medical oncologists, which this one was, and also investigators. This one was pretty interesting. You're going to see a whole bunch of cases from these docs. We sort of developed a new way to sort of ask people about cases, and we started this with the GI ASCO meeting a couple months ago. We got a lot of really great cases. Same thing here. More than 100 cases that we had submitted here. We're going to pick out a few. We're going to do a second webinar after ASCO on the same topic. We'll update you on what happened at ASCO, but also present more of these cases. We also put in some sort of board-like questions for these oncologists to take of what they do in various situations, and we'll take a look at that in a second. One thing I'll say that's very interesting is it's always interesting for us to see how quickly data gets picked up. And, of course, one of the things we looked at in this survey was whether people are using the PATINA strategy, adding on CDK, palbociclib, in the first-line setting. We've seen in investigators, like a month after the data was presented, we saw investigators saying, I'm ready to use it. They were starting to try to use it. I kind of felt like we were going to see the same thing here a year later. But as you're going to see, maybe not necessarily. We also asked about the HER-CLIMB study and the use of tucatinib. Again, not necessarily a huge pickup, and we'll sort of take a look at that and kind of see, maybe try to figure out what it means. I also mentioned that it was kind of interesting trying to pick out the cases. I thought maybe I could put it into some kind of AI thing and figure out what the best cases were, but it turns out the best approach to AI was just reading every single one of these cases, which I did over the last week, and trying to pick those out, but try to combine it with a little exercise as well. Anyway, it was easy. Like the first three cases were like incredible cases. So I'm really looking forward to that. But I want to first get into a little bit of biology, just a touch of it, particularly as it relates to interaction between HER2 and ER. I want to recommend this paper from the Clinical Breast Cancer Journal. Excellent review. If there's somebody out there particularly interested in breast cancer, very comprehensive. Tons of papers cited. Also, a really cool graphic that I didn't include because, you know, graphics, I'd rather hear people discuss stuff about mechanisms, but you're into mechanisms, you can check that out as well. One of the things that came out here, and I'm just kind of curious, Ginger, whether you agree with their summary from this paper. We adapted this from it. Is the characteristic of triple positive versus ER negative HER2 positive disease. And they have an interesting table here and the references, but we just tried to summarize it. So Ginger, the bottom line of what they say here is when you look at it, you see more late relapses with triple positive, more bone only metastatic disease, median survival increase compared to ER negative, even though maybe they respond better. Less de novo disease, less visceral mets, and actually less grade 3 tumors. Does that sort of sync up with your clinical experience and what you've seen in the literature in terms of trying to characterize triple positive disease, Ginger?
Yeah, I would say this is a great reflection of what we tend to see in triple positive breast cancer. The effect of being hormone receptor positive is sort of the same effect as if you were going to look at hormone receptor positive versus triple negative and ignore the whole HER2 side of the equation for now. One of the other things that has been described by several groups is the fact that in triple positive breast cancer, it is a little bit more common in younger women. That too is one of the trends that has been reported that I don't see reflected in this manuscript.
That's a great point. I know you have a great interest in that. I've done a lot of great research on young women. So let's get more into the biology and pharmacology here. So, there's a great graphic here explaining it, but I like it when people just explain it the way they would on rounds without slides. So how do you conceptualize the interaction between HER2 and ER at a basic level for basic people like me, Ion? And then what do we know about the efficacy of anti-HER therapy based on whether the ER is positive or negative? Remember back with the neoadjuvant trials, we first started to see that there was better path CR with ER negative, HER2 positive. Although the neratinib-extenet study, which, of course, is a TKI, you saw more benefit with the ER positive. So, Ian, can you paint a picture for us of how these pathways interact and clinically what we see in terms of the benefit of anti-HER therapy based on ER?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question and certainly one that matters to us in the clinic. I think the simplest way to at least the simplest way I think about the fact of what's going on inside of a triple positive cancer is that you now, in those cancers, you have two drivers of proliferation. You have both ER and HER2. When they're both on, they tend to antagonize each other a little bit. When HER2 is driving a cancer, it tends to suppress ER. But from the clinic, from what we think is most important, is that when you block just one of those two pathways, the other one can take over the growth of the cancer. And so if we've seen that in multiple trials, that if you just block HER2, estrogen receptor signaling can help support the cancer. And that's probably one of the main reasons why we see less benefit of HER2 therapy in ER positives or triple positive cancers compared to ER negative HER2 positive cancers, and vice versa. I think perhaps one difference or one reason to explain why we see somewhat the opposite effect with the neratinib-extenet trial is because that was a trial in which everybody was getting endocrine therapy and they were adding HER2 therapy to that. We see that in that case, it's thought that, or at least one explanation is that in those ER, in those triple positive cancers that were on endocrine therapy, the HER2 was driving driving resistance to the endocrine therapy. And so when you add the TKI, you block that HER2 signal, and that allows the endocrine therapy to have benefit. But in truth, we don't really know why there was this difference, but that's one explanation. I think in the big picture, though, in general, the HER2 therapies work best in hormone receptor positive, I'm sorry, in the HER2 positive hormone receptor negative compared to the triple positives.
So, Ginger, the other issue, and it was interesting, we did a webinar a few weeks ago with Hope Rugo and Sarah Tulaney, and Hope and Sarah also were both saying that they felt like in the metastatic setting, we're actually looking at trials of ADCs, but in terms of the use of hormonal therapy, that they felt that maybe people in the community or people were getting in these trials were not using endocrine therapy as much as they do, for example. So I'm curious what we know about, and I think the Patina trial really woke us all up about this whole issue of endocrine therapy and hormone receptor triple positive disease. What do we know, though, right now about the impact of endocrine therapy? We use it in the post-adjuvant or localized disease, post-neoadjuvant setting all the time. What about in the metastatic setting? What do we know about efficacy of hormonal therapy? We'll get to Patina in a second, but what preceded Patina in terms of that question, and also in terms of the effects of CDK inhibitors, again, in triple-positive disease, Ginger?
Yeah, so I think it is always incredibly important to remember that whichever one of these pathways is there, ER and or HER2, they have their independent contribution to how that cancer is going to try to divide and survive. And if you are targeting one, you are allowing it to go right down the escape mechanism of the other, and you have to remember to hit both. Now, that's complicated because when we talk about many of the advances in HER2-positive breast cancer with the ADCs, we don't really bring the ER targeting into the conversation, but it is almost, an important part of a lot of the different therapies. You're asking about the, relative efficacy of endocrine therapy independent of the HER2 status in HR-positive breast cancer. It works. The estrogen is a food source for that cancer, and we need to block it to get optimal results. You layer on top of it the HER2 positive, and I think the easiest message to remember is don't forget about the hormone receptor positivity. What we know is that these two pathways actually cross at cyclin D1, and cyclin D1 binds with CDK4 and CDK6 to drive cell proliferation, and the best way to kill cancer is to stop it from being able to proliferate and divide. So it is not at all a surprise in both the very robust level of preclinical data we currently have and some of the emerging clinical data that if you triple target HER2, the hormone receptor, and get it at this intersection point at the cyclin D1 with the CDK4/6 inhibition, because that's this conglomerate that has to happen, we see even larger improvements. In preclinical evidence, if you don't hit it in the triple manner, there'll still be the opportunity for these cell lines to keep growing and to bypass doublet therapy. That goes with the results we saw in the early metastatic setting when we were trying to just do hormone targeting on top of HER2 targeted, where we saw pretty modest results. Now we have triple targeting. We have some smaller studies that were done in later metastatic disease with abemaciclib and palbociclib being overlapped with HER2-targeted either monoclonal antibody or TKI-based therapy in combination with hormone blockade, and those showed really strong results. That was the backbone that led us to the PATINA trial, where palbociclib is being added into maintenance therapy along with scripted endocrine-targeted therapy and HER2-targeted therapy with the monoclonal antibodies. And PATINA is really a dramatic result. We see a significant improvement in the hazard ratio and progression-free survival in that study. It is at this point relatively early in its follow-up, but we're already seeing that the progression-free survival is 44 months for those patients getting triple-targeted therapy. It is a study that has a lot of upfront de novo metastatic patients, but even so, those are striking results.
All right, let's jump into the cases a little bit just to kind of keep clinical care in our minds. And this is actually the first case I looked at. I'm like, wow, we got to present this case. So I'm just briefly, here's the bottom line. 70-year-old woman, de novo, triple positive, widely metastatic disease, including an asymptomatic brain met. Ian, you might comment on how common or uncommon it is in HER2 disease to start out with a brain met. This patient got started on T-DXd and pertuzumab a la DB09, but had severe diarrhea. Again, curious, Ian, how often you've seen that. Actually had to be hospitalized, treatment interrupted. They held the pertuzumab. She's responding to therapy at all sites, including the brain. They don't mention RT, so I don't know. Maybe they just gave her systemic therapy. The question is, given this history of severe diarrhea, would you bring back the pertuzumab or just keep going with T-DXd? Of course, we know DB09 has a T-DXd arm alone. We haven't seen it reported. And then, of course, the question that a lot of people ask, which is, would you go to the PATINA regimen of AI, PALBO, and trastuzumab? Quote, is this your new standard? Ian, any thoughts about this case?
A lot of interesting questions here. I think for this particular patient who, having a lot of trouble with diarrhea, when the combination of pertuzumab and T-DXd was used and now is tolerating T-DXd alone well and responding well, I probably would just leave her on the T-DXd. As you said, we don't have any definitive data now yet that says that adding pertuzumab to T-DXd is better than T-DXd alone. We know T-DXd alone is very effective in later lines of therapy. So I think she's doing well now, and I would just leave her on the T-DXd. It's possible that you could adding back the pertuzumab and with, you know, very good supportive care, you could manage it. But, you know, again, I think she's doing well. I probably would leave her on the T-DXd alone. In terms of when to switch to AI palbo-trastuzumab perpetina, you know, we don't have any data yet on maintenance therapy after T-DXd. So I think, you know, it's an open question of whether there is an optimal maintenance therapy in patients who were on T-DXd. I think in the trial, patients stayed on T-DXd until progression or until intolerable toxicity. And, you know, I think if she started developing significant toxicity to T-DXd, I certainly would, you know, either if I can't dose reduce and have benefit, I'd stop the T-DXd and switch her to HP alone. Or HP with endocrine therapy. But I wouldn't, you know, right now I'm not automatically putting patients on patina after T-DXd.
Ginger?
Yeah, I would just add to everything Ian has said in that this patient has a solitary asymptotic brain metastasis. And as you pointed out, we don't know if she is receiving any definitive local therapy. One of the upsides of keeping her on the T-DXd, particularly if she is tolerating it, is that you have her on a brain active drug that has been shown both in later line therapy and here that it will help control that brain metastasis so that you could delay the need for local therapy. If you switch her to the maintenance regimen, we don't have that level of data for the brain metastasis. If you had eliminated the brain met, then I think it's more tempting to contemplate switching her to the maintenance regimen for the perception that it is easier. Although I think in a 70-year-old woman, if you've got her on a drug that she's tolerating, you should ride that because you don't know that palbo is necessarily going to be easier.
Yeah, it's interesting when we show you the response of the oncologist. If you have a brain net, they're much more likely to use T-DXd as part of induction. So we'll get to this question here. Is this your new standard? Because I thought it was the new standard because we've been surveying investigators about patina ever since the data was presented. And, you know, as soon as it was presented, people were telling us, oh, yeah, the investigators were saying we're ready to use it. We did a survey for ASCA. Everybody was using it. We didn't exactly see that here in this survey. It's always interesting. We saw a big pickup with the GMOs for the SERENA-6 study, incidentally. More GMOs were pro-SERENA-6 than the investigators, so it's always interesting to see. We're waiting to see what people are going to say about Ladira, but that's sort of another story. Or let me see if I can slide in one more case, and then we're going to get into the data. I just thought this next one was really interesting and different. So, again, I'll start with you, Ian. 69-year-old woman presents with a palpable left neck node, triple positive, ER positive, HER2 positive, metastatic lobular cancer. Question, how often you see that with lobular cancer? No breast mass. No mammogram is negative. Multiple bone mets. Endoscopy shows a gastric polyp that contains lobular cancer. She gets HP paclitaxel and after 12 weeks switched to patina, letrozole, and palbo. In June of 2023, so now I guess 2.5 years ago, she's doing well on this treatment. No toxicity. She's been maintained on sub-Q, HP, and palbo and letrozole. Stable bone scans, zoledronic acid. So, Ian, first of all, do you see HER2 positive lobular cancer? No primary here that they can find. What do you think? The doc also wants to know: should the endoscopy be repeated?
So it is, you know, lobular breast cancer typically is HER2 negative, but in a few percent, they can be HER2 positive, and lobular cancer definitely can, metastasize to the gastric mucosa. It's actually, I think those of us who treat a lot of breast cancer see this not so rarely. I've had patients where the only way to stage them or to check on the efficacy of therapy is to do endoscopies to make sure that you're having benefit. So it's definitely something that we see. And I think it's you know, she essentially has de novo metastatic disease, so I'm not surprised that she's had a very nice response to the Cleopatra regimen, is now doing well on Patina. And so I would hope that she would be on that regimen and, for a very long time, perhaps, indefinitely.
So here are a couple questions about first-line therapy. I know we can do surveys all day long, but I just like to ask people and you tell me what you do. So Ginger, pretty straightforward question, but I think the answer may be a little complicated. Obviously, a lot of discussion about this since ASCO. What's your current usual first-line therapy in the metastatic HER2-positive situation? Obviously, a big question about Cleopatra versus T-DXd pertuzumab. If you do use either one of these, but particularly if you're using T-DXd with pertuzumab, how long are you treating, assuming the patient's tolerating well? And how do you factor in prior adjuvant or neoadjuvant treatment into your decision?
Yeah, so I would say that the answer to
30 seconds or less.
Okay. De novo versus just recurrent kidding. Makes a huge difference in what my decision making will be, because if somebody is relapsing out of the adjuvant setting, which I do have patients who have barely finished their TDM1 after residual disease, after TCHP in the neoadjuvant setting, then obviously I'd be reaching for T-DXd-P. And have seen great results there. And I have had some patients who had bad local recurrences, so not fully metastatic. So we're kind of doing a treat for curative intent, hoping that we can get there with multimodality therapy. But what I am coming in with first is T-DXd-P. I think in the de novo setting, it's a little bit still of a dealer's choice, depending on, we have data that if it's an oligometastatic case, and we meaning the field in general, that you can come at this in a multimodality approach and you will have some very long-term survivors. We always hesitate to say cured when somebody has biopsy-proven metastatic disease, but there's even questions of when you do that and you have them then on long-term maintenance, how long should you even continue that for? So if I'm going to go more of a lower disease burden, both in the breast, the lymph nodes, but they have some level of oligometastatic disease, I would still potentially consider Cleopatra followed by maintenance with the Patina regimen if they're ER positive. If they have a higher burden of disease, like they're more of a stage 3C, and then you found the metastatic disease where you're really going to be worried about local control, potential for chest wall involvement down the line, probably lean more towards the T-DXd-P just to get the best response, the best drugs in there first. And then whether to continue on that versus switch over to maintenance is going to be totally based on tolerance and a discussion with the patient given the data we have and don't have.
So, Ian, I'm sure we could talk about this for about an hour, but maybe just sort of summarize again your approach to induction treatment in the first-line setting. Does it change based on the patient's age, whether they're symptomatic or not, whether they have visceral disease, CNS disease? Does HR status, endocrine status affect your approach? How are you currently approaching first-line induction, Ian?
Yeah, no, I feel like we're at a point now where, a one-size-fits-all approach really is not ideal, and that, many of the factors that Ginger brought up, should be included in your decision-making, and of course the patient's preference as well. But, patients, essentially, our patients either really in need of a durable, high response rate, if they have a high burden of disease, if they're very symptomatic, if they have brain mets, that's certainly a patient who I'm going to start with T-DXd-P. Patients who don't have such a high disease burden, then I think the question is, is this a patient who's likely to do well with THP? So if they, if they have high HER2 levels, we know that's a predictor of good response to THP. If you do molecular profiling, looking for PI3 kinase mutations, those don't do as well treated with THP. So I think there's a number of factors. And of course, the one that Ginger pointed out, how you know, are they de novo patients who are going to likely do well with THP, or are they someone who recurred after having received, you know, taxanes and trastuzumab and pertuzumab in the early disease setting? They're less likely to respond as well to give it again. If it's 5-6 years out, certainly I'm happy to retry it. But if it's, you know, less than that, then I'm going to try to switch classes and go with the ADC.
So we're getting some great cases in the chat room as well. I'll try to get to them as well. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about the data. I think everybody's certainly familiar with the Cleopatra data, but also DB09 that was, again, presented at ASCO with the really impressive results compared to the Cleopatra strategy of THP, greater response rates. There was a little bit of a difference in terms of hormone receptors, as we're about to get into, and as Ian already commented on this point a little bit early in terms of survival. I think we're all familiar with what to expect in terms of adverse events. It looked like in this early situation it was pretty much what we expected. And then in December, we saw the actual approval. This is what I want to get your feedback on. This is what I kind of found surprising. So Ginger, we put up several scenarios here. So we're starting out here with a 65-year-old patient in good condition, a triple positive. And then the question would be, what this patient has asymptomatic bone mets. And so here we see about 50-50 whether or not they're going to use TDXD. But then if you say they have symptomatic liver mets, you see a lot more TDXD. Now, more than half, actually two-thirds of the people say TDXD. And if we say brain mets, a la what you've both been saying, much more likely to use TDXD. We also asked about age, younger patients. Ginger, again, your interest. Not much difference, actually, in terms of these decisions. I think, in general, age has become just a number, assuming the patient has good performance status. Any thoughts about this? I was surprised. Like I said, it seems like every time we ask investigators, they say patina, but we're not seeing that here, Ginger. Any thoughts about what's going on?
Well, in terms of the decision-making between the TDXD and pertuzumab versus the Cleopatra regimen, I would say I see this level of breakout 50-50 if you give sort of an average age, good performance status, not a lot of disease. The minute we get into high visceral burden brain mets, I think all of us are very inclined to reach to the combination that has a very powerful and fast response rate for the majority of people who are on it, as well as duration of response. You know, when you get into the older patient population, certainly you have to be careful there about toxicities and, you know, how are they going to do on the pertuzumab? That's an equal problem in whichever regimen there that you're choosing. But I think that there's a higher comfort level with Cleopatra. So if you're going to give it to somebody more frail, that might be a reason we're seeing a higher rate being chosen there, as opposed to, you know, could you lean in with TDXD and pertuzumab and contemplate dose reduction or something along those lines and still offer that benefit?
You know, just to emphasize the fact that some people do well on Cleopatra, Ian, Karen Green in the chat room has a 48-year-old woman who presented with de novo metastatic disease in 2019, got Taxol HP, had a CR, has been on maintenance HP, ovarian suppression, and an AI for 7 years, remains NED. She wants to know, can she stop the HP and keep the endocrine therapy alone? Any role for cell-free DNA in a case like this, Ian?
Well, first off, I think it is a really important point, and you showed it in the Cleopatra trial data set that you flashed up there quickly. 16% of patients on Cleopatra had, you know, essentially 8 year progression-free survival out to 8 years. So they, you know, like the patient that you just mentioned, very likely that those patients are cured, and that was without endocrine therapy, because in Cleopatra, endocrine therapy was not allowed. So presumably, even patients will do even better now that we're using endocrine therapy in this setting. So I do think it's there are patients who do well. The question of whether to use ctDNA, we don't know whether that's something that's useful in that setting. I'm happy to say that within the consortium called the TBCRC, or Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium, that's a United States trial group. They have now done a prospective trial of stopping HER2 therapy after at least 3 years of disease control, and should have the results of that next year. So I think hopefully we'll be able to answer the person in the chat room's question definitively. But I think we all know that there are patients who you can stop therapy and they will continue to do well. Whether ctDNA is going to help you decide that question, I think, is very possible. We'll have that data in this prospective trial I mentioned.
Let's talk about maintenance. Let's start out. We're going to talk about HR positive to HR negative in a second, and also the HER-CLIMB study and the use of tucatinib. But let's start out with the issue of triple positive disease. And again, Ginger, can you comment about how you're thinking through maintenance therapy, particularly if you give a patient T-DXd, but even if it's a Cleopatra strategy, how are you thinking through whether or not you're going to employ the Patina regimen? How long do you keep the maintenance going, assuming the patient's tolerating well? How do you factor in prior treatment with either endocrine therapy or HER2-targeted therapy? How are you thinking through maintenance, and when do you start thinking about it, and with T-DXd or either one, actually?
Yeah, I think, one of the challenges is we all have patients who never even got pertuzumab but are doing phenomenally well on, just with trastuzumab before pertuzumab was around, many, many years down the line, no evidence of disease return, many of whom have stopped treatment. So the idea of a biomarker or some form of analysis that will let us know who are going to be the exceptional responders with the lesser treatment versus those who we do really need to lean in on with all of this is not answerable today, but like Ian said, great studies coming that will help us figure that out. For right now, certainly if I have a patient who has already been doing well, like they got Cleopatra, they're fine. I'm not adding to their treatment regimen now, but new patients that are moving forward into this algorithm, if I've more recently just finished giving them the chemo portion of the Cleopatra, I am offering them the palbociclib or the Patina trial if they're hormone receptor positive as well. I think it's important to block the potential crosstalk resistance that can develop when you have both of these pathways active in the cancer. And as you've alluded to, I typically take care of people who are 45 and under. So these are people who have decades of life to protect if we can manage it. And certainly while I have some very long-term survivors, I have many more who have gone on to get brain mets and not have that outcome. So upfront, I'm adding it. If somebody is on T-DXd-P as their frontline regimen for all the reasons we just talked about, so far I've been leaving them on that as long as they tolerate it. If they have toxicities or reasons why they need a break, then I would certainly put them on maintenance. I wouldn't have them on no therapy, and using a Patina strategy if they are hormone receptor positive. It's a data-free decision, but we've often had to make intuition of what are the best things we can do for our patients based on parallel trial results. So I like the idea of best on top of best if I'm going to go in that direction.
So Ian, can you comment on the same question, how you approach maintenance, whether you're using Cleopatra or T-DXd, pertuzumab? Does it vary based on age? Are you using it in older patients, like, for example, over the 85? Does tucatinib have a role in this situation? When we were talking with Hope, she brought up an algorithm of tucatinib for ER negative, palbo for ER positive. But what about tucatinib and palbo? And also, if you are going to use a Patina-like regimen, are you going to use palbo, or would you use another? Somebody in the chat room brought up brain mets. Would you use abema? And how do you deal with neutropenia in terms of the palbo and what's on top of the HP, Ian?
I follow very similar kind of rationale as Ginger does in the maintenance setting. I definitely have been using the Patina regimen. I think that, we're all very comfortable dealing with the neutropenia associated with CDK4/6 inhibitors, and it doesn't seem any worse not substantially worse in this setting. Very few patients in Patina had to come off because of toxicities, so it's a pretty well-tolerated regimen. definitely use it. In terms of tucatinib, I follow what Hope Rugo has been saying, which is for an ER-negative, HER2-positive cancer, I find the HER2-CLIMB-05 data fairly compelling. There's a hazard ratio is like 0.5-something, clearly effective. But for hormone receptor-positive, HER2-positives, for the triple-positives, Palbo is just an easier drug to give. There's definitely less toxicity, and the results are quite good as we've talked about. So for the triple positives, I tend to use maintenance Palbo, and for the ER negative HER2 positives, I would use tucatinib, assuming it's going to be available.
So we can actually just saw the recent publication of the Patina trial in the New England Journal. It took about a year. Actually, Bertha in the chat room brings up the issue of the patient has brain mets, even if they're triple positive, would you be more inclined to use tucatinib? But I'll hold off on that till we take a look at the data that was just presented on Patina with brain mets, which is kind of interesting and surprising. But anyhow, the paper of Patina has been published. If you haven't seen it, obviously, it was very dramatic improvement in progression-free survival, going from 29 to 44 months, really impressive. Response rates are greater as well. It's interesting, too, looking at the types of people in the study. More than a third of them were premenopausal, as you can see. Low median age here, like 53 in the trial. This is another thing. We talk about triple positive, but actually a third of these people were progesterone receptor negative, I guess just to keep in mind. Most of these patients were 3-plus IHC, but some were 2-plus amplified. Very few CNS mets in the Patina study. Most of them have been on 6 cycles of induction, as we've just been talking about. And about half of them were metastatic, de novo metastatic, maybe reflecting the fact that people with localized disease are doing better and better, or maybe not relapsing to get into a study like that. And actually, interestingly, only a third of them had prior localized disease. Of course, the de novo patients had never had it. And a high fraction of the patients had a response, but actually only almost a third of them had stable disease. And then again, the type of hormonal therapy, what you expect, mainly an AI. I think as Ian was saying, I think we saw what we expected based on what we know about Palbo, particularly in terms of neutropenia. This is the thing that surprised me. I was curious what you think about this, Ginger. This was presented at San Antonio looking at CNS events. And I don't remember hearing much. I've heard a little bit about Abema, although not too much data. But you tell me, what does this mean to you? It looks like there's less CNS progression, Ginger, with Patina. Any thoughts?
I think anytime there's less cancer progression, you definitely remove the opportunity for it to also get past the blood-brain barrier up into the brain. I think we don't have great insights between the three CDK4/6 inhibitors in terms of a lot of differences with getting up and being able to affect in the brain. I don't tend to think of it as a particularly brain active regimen. The numbers here were surprising to me as well, so I think I have to go back and rethink that. Typically, I still lean towards those drugs that have a bit stronger evidence in brain metastasis from multiple studies and multiple years of follow-up now, meaning TDXD or tucatinib if I've got somebody with de facto brain mets that have to get factored in, especially if I'm going to try and stave off local therapy to the brain.
And of course, as we mentioned, TDXD also has CNS activity. Ian, any thoughts about the CNS data? And also at ESMO, we saw, I always love patient-reported outcomes. And here, where we're looking mainly for toxicity and symptoms from treatment, you see quality of life measurements and really about the same as you would expect with Palbo, extremely well-tolerated drug. Anything you want to add to what Ginger said? Any comments about CNS activity, Ian?
Yeah, so we have a little bit of data suggesting that abemaciclib may have a little, has some activity in the brain. Whether it's really substantive, substantially different than palbociclib or ribociclib, I think we don't have the kind of head-to-head data that would say that. And it's certainly not trivial to say, okay, well, we're just going to start using the Patina regimen with abemaciclib HP as opposed to ribociclib HP because of the, you know, the real concern about added toxicity of trying to combine pertuzumab and abemaciclib from a diarrhea standpoint. So I don't think it's really an option to just switch to abemaciclib. It would really need to be tested in a trial. So I think that's my thought. Again, I'm happy to use palbociclib in these patients, and the CNS data that you showed from Dr. Metzger, is very reassuring and a pleasant surprise.
So, and of course, we saw at San Antonio the HERCLIMB 05 study looking at tucatinib. Of course, this is ER positive and ER negative. And we saw significant benefit by adding tucatinib to maintenance HP in terms of PFS, maybe a little bit less benefit in the HR positive, no survival benefit at this point, and I think, again, the expected toxicity. Here's what I really am curious about. I've kind of been alluding to this, but this is what surprised me, Ginger. 65-year-old, good condition, who has a CR, to THP, and now the question is what kind of maintenance in this triple-positive patients. And to my surprise, and at least this aliquot here, we saw only half the people saying patina. More people said patina or palbo if the patient only had a partial response. And here we have a case of a patient who gets T-DXd and pertuzumab as the induction, and we said, what would you do in terms of, again, in a triple-positive patient who had a complete response? A lot of variability. Some people would keep the TDXD going. Some would do it with ET. But we do see 44% in this situation saying they would use patina for a patient with a CR, and then about the same in a patient with a PR. We also asked whether or not they would use another CDK. The most common answer was no, but there were people who seemed open to that. So this is what I wanted to ask you, Ginger. I kind of figured everybody would be like the investigators and be using patina, but we're not really seeing that here. Any thoughts about what's going on?
Well, I think it highlights the importance of, webinars. And we really want to emphasize that the addition of palbociclib to that maintenance regimen had substantial improvement for patients. And I think even if you were disinclined to add the palbociclib, it's a fantastic reminder that you have to make sure you are targeting the hormone receptor and not just continuing HER2 maintenance therapy in the absence of including that. Personally, as we've been talking about, very clear scientific evidence that if you are not now taking the opportunity to add palbociclib to your maintenance regimen, you are leaving the door open for this cancer to decide its escape mechanism and to, have a patient who is not going to be long-term benefiting from the regimen where they otherwise could. I mean, 44-month progression-free survival is pretty jaw-dropping, and I think it is in part why you hear experts like Hope talking about how they would lean in on patina rather than using tucatinib in the ER-positive space. It's a little bit of an unfair cross-trial comparison for everything we talked about, HER2CLIMB-05 being more of a balanced of metastatic and de novo, and also the endocrine therapy not being scripted, but you just can't deny those numbers. And everybody wants their patient to have 44 months of progression-free survival in the first-line setting on a maintenance regimen if we can offer that to them. So I do hope we see an uptick. I think part of the reason is it's not yet been FDA approved, so it's hard to do things in depending on where you practice. If you are in a very HMO restricted, must be on guideline, must be approved type of practice, you're just not going to have the opportunity. And I've had patients I've wanted to give them the palbociclib and could not because their insurance would not approve it in the absence of the publication being available and also it being, approved. Now, I think the other question, getting back to agreeing completely with Ian, I don't think we can just swap around CDK4/6 inhibitors. We don't know the safety data there. A little bit earlier in our conversation today, you brought up the hypothesis of, well, what about tucatinib and a CDK4/6 inhibitor? There is a study published from my group looking at tucatinib, letrozole, and palbociclib. It was efficacious. It's not a guideline-based regimen, so I'm not encouraging it. I bring it up only to point out that there can be drug-drug interactions. So palbociclib and tucatinib do have a drug-drug interaction, and you have to reduce the dose of palbociclib to 75 milligrams. So that was not a known or expected thing when that regimen got started. And so you can't just sort of decide to do these things in the absence of safety data. It's not good for our patients.
So, Ian, you know, every time we do these surveys, I think I wish we'd asked some other question. I wasn't anticipating these results, so, but if I did it again, I would say why. And I wonder, as Ginger was alluding to, maybe it was more like an access thing. Maybe people are aware of the data, but they haven't been able to get access. I think it just recently got NCCN labeled, and a lot of people go to NCCN, a lot of the insurers do. Anything you want to add to this in terms of where things are right now and where things are heading? Do you think we're going to end up adding in tucatinib on top of palbo, Ian?
Well, I think to do that would require, you know, a fairly definitive trial, because you're definitely going to add toxicity when you add the additional agent, and you know, these are drugs that patients are going to be on for years now. So toxicity really matters in this setting. But I do think that, and I hope that we're going to see more uptake of the Patina regimen for the triple positives. As you know, I said the NCCN guidelines is out. The New England Journal article just came out, and you know, hopefully we'll get some FDA approval as well. I think that it's over time we're going to see more and more uptake as we get more information.
So let's talk about maintenance in the hormone receptor negative, HER2 positive situation, and again the potential role of tucatinib. Ginger, how are you approaching these patients right now? How would you like to approach them? You know, would you like to be able to use tucatinib? In what situations would you do it? Does it matter what kind of induction, whether it's T-DXd or THP? How long would you use the tucatinib maintenance strategy, the HERCLIMB strategy? Is it different based on age? How are you approaching these patients from a maintenance point of view, Ginger?
So let's start off with a patient who has received the CLEOPATRA regimen, is now going to be on maintenance. I would add in the tucatinib. I have a big track record of patients ending up with CNS dominant disease. And while we know tucatinib can do an excellent job of treating that, and also some data to allude to the fact that it may help prevent the emergence of more CNS disease, that's very valuable in my opinion. Biomarkers to know exactly what that patient is that needs that addition versus the ones who would otherwise be the long-term exceptional responder is sorely needed as we keep bringing about these not only added toxicity but added expense regimens. Then if you get to the patient who I've given the TDX-DP, if for any reason they were not tolerating being able to continue on that and was moving to a substitution maintenance regimen, if they already have brain mets, then absolutely I'm going to incorporate the tucatinib. And in the absence of that, I guess I'll have to decide when I get there, because I haven't had that case yet. We're figuring this out as we go along, Neil.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. This is all pretty new stuff. I mean, you're getting changes in the induction and the maintenance, and data coming in with both of them. Ian, any thoughts? Again, this kind of gets into going from research to practice, so to speak. And of course, again, access makes a big difference here. Maybe we should have said putting reimbursement aside. We do that sometimes when we ask these questions. Maybe we should have said that. But anyhow, when we present this scenario to the general oncologist, we say 65-year-old who does have ER-negative, HER2-positive disease, whether they have, if they have a complete response, the majority of them don't use tucatinib. If they have a partial response, the majority, well, more than a little bit more than half, more of them use tucatinib, but still about half don't use tucatinib. Does this sort of line up with what you're doing? When we saw kind of the same thing when we said, suppose they had TDXD pertuzumab up front. Again, the minority of people saying tucatinib. Any thoughts? Are you using it? Do you want to use it?
Yeah, no, I think the data from HER2CLIMB-05, particularly in the ER-negative, HER2-positive patients, is quite compelling. It actually looks like, you know, you get more benefit in that group than you do in the ER-positives, and we don't have the CDK, you know, option. So I do think it's something that, you know, once reimbursement gets clarified, that that it should be, that I will typically use in the maintenance phase.
All right, well, let's see if we can go through a few cases, and we'll probably pick up on a lot of the questions we've been talking about as we go. So Ginger here is a patient with ER-negative, HER2-positive disease, a 52-year-old woman, history of hypertension, syncope, GERD, depression. She originally has stage 2B disease, gets a neoadjuvant TCHP, adjuvant radiation HP. I guess she had a CR. On surveillance for 2 years and then develops asymptomatic bone mets. She's getting THP and HP maintenance. Wants to know, looking back, would you have given this same patient TDXD pertuzumab? And what would you do about maintenance in a situation like this? Would you use tucatinib? Ginger?
I think with someone who progressed with asymptomatic bone metastases, the Cleopatra regimen followed by HP maintenance adding in tucatinib based on the HER2CLIMB-05 data would still be a valid strategy. The preference over TDXDP versus Cleopatra for a patient who's really asymptomatic and has bone mets, you certainly could do that. The data would support it. That would not be my probable tendency. I think I would still lean on Cleopatra there.
Any comments, second opinion from Ian?
Nope, I agree 100%.
All right, well, let's see if I can get you two to argue about an 86-year-old lady. I should say to the audience, this is like oncology improv. The faculty has not seen these cases. They're like throwing it up, and this is like rocket rounds. But okay, keeping that in mind. All right, so Ian, 86-year-old woman, history of DCIS, which I think is really interesting, presents with metastatic disease. That's pretty interesting. With weight loss, liver masses, biopsy of the liver. So it's HER2 2+, FISH negative, high-grade IDC. But she also has a breast mass, and that one is HER2 2+, but the FISH is positive. So the first question is, are you going to treat this as HER2 positive? Second question, if you are, which I think probably a lot of people would, what about TDXD in an 86-year-old? Would you do a dose reduction? What's your experience in older people? Would you hold the pertuzumab for cycle one in an 86-year-old? What about tucatinib, even though she's ER? What's her ER here? Yeah, she's ER positive, right? Oh, no, ER negative, sorry. Would you give her tucatinib? Would you give tucatinib to an 86-year-old, Ian? Again, would you call her HER2 positive? She's got discrepant HER2 results. You pick the HER2 positive one?
Well, I guess the nice thing about TDXD is it doesn't matter. You know, it's going to work, and you know, it has efficacy in the first line for both HER2 positives and HER2 lows, which this would theoretically be if the FISH was negative. You know, and we do have data with TDXD in older patients. We actually did a subset analysis of patients in all the DESTINY trials, and the efficacy is exactly the same. There is somewhat higher toxicity, so you have to be careful. You know, I think in this patient, I think you could make an argument for either TDXD because you think it may have better efficacy than THP, but it's an 86-year-old, and so depending on her performance status, I mean, it says KPS is 90 there. I would actually let her decide. I would say I think you could do either one of these things. You could start out with THP, and then you know, if she doesn't have response, we know TDXD works great in the second line setting, and if she does have response, then you could put her on HP and try tucatinib, and if she doesn't tolerate the tucatinib, drop it.
So actually, you know, we always present cases at San Antonio, and the San Antonio before, we had two patients in their 90s who got TDXD. They actually did dose reduce, and both of them responded, tolerated well. This year, we had a 103-year-old patient with metastatic disease presented, and actually, she was actually ends up treated with hormonal therapy, but she was treated. She wanted to be treated, and she's living alone, taking care of herself. So, like I said, age is just a number. All right, let's take a look at another case. So, Ginger, 49-year-old, younger woman, triple-positive disease, liver and bone mets. She gets THP and HP maintenance plus letrozole. And wants to know, looking back, would you have given this patient TDXD and also the Patina regimen? This person, the doc brings up the issue of, are you concerned about, even if the patient's tolerating TDXD well, the risk of pneumonitis, does that increase with the longer you use it? So any thoughts about this younger patient has a visceral disease? Is this a TDXD pertuzumab slash Patina situation for you, Ginger?
It certainly might have been, although as this case is presented, we see that this patient had an excellent response and was able to stay on maintenance for 2 years. So it shows you that while we lean in on the idea of using TDXDP in the setting of visceral disease, some patients are going to be absolutely fine, whichever regimen we choose. Not to sound like a broken record, but better biomarkers to help figure this out would be phenomenal. With the idea of, sure, so we know that pneumonitis is something that is a cumulative issue with TDXD. Usually you don't see it before a handful of cycles, although I have had one case where I saw it after the second cycle. It was endoscopy proven to be drug-induced pneumonitis, which surprised me. But that alone would not be a reason for me to take somebody off of that regimen if they are doing great on it, given the data that we have. And you could think of it as a forever regimen, but again, at some point, probably there'll be a discussion with the patient of, you know, is this what they want to keep doing? Do they need a break? Do they want to switch to maintenance? But for now, given the data that we have, I don't know that I would want the field to automatically assume that coming off of TDXDP onto a maintenance regimen is the right choice if you're going to follow the DB09 data.
So, Ian, anything you want to add to that? Also, a quick question from the chat room. For people who've already been started on HP maintenance, and the doc here hasn't heard about Patina, and patient's triple positive, they're on this webinar today. Could you add in palbo after the fact? How long after they get started? Let's say they got started on AIHP. If it's 2-3 months later, would you add in the palbo? If it's a year later, any thoughts about that? Anything else you want to add to what Ginger just said about that case?
Nothing to add to Ginger's excellent comments. In terms of adding palbo to someone who's already been on maintenance HP endocrine therapy, yes. Certainly 2-3 months, you know, I wouldn't do it longer than a year. So somewhere in that first year of therapy, depending on the patient, I would certainly offer them this based on the data.
So Ginger and Ian, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Ginger. Thanks so much, Ian. Great to work with you
again.
Thanks, Neil. Good conversation.